Conference record has joined the conference.
All right. Well, good evening, everyone. I'm glad you could join us tonight for this week's topical call on dispute resolution and resolving conflicts in the school setting. So I hope everybody was able to get the PowerPoint that they were sent. Did anybody have any trouble opening it? Okay, not silence is consensus, so we'll keep moving. So without further ado, Kathy Harstead is with us tonight from Pathfinder Family Center, and Kathy has done a great job on a number of calls with us for this evening, and it helps our grants and it helps her grants, so it's been a great partnership, and Kathy's just been a great person to work with, so Kathy, take it away, because I know you're going to do a fantastic job.
Well, thank you. With that kind of an introduction, I better now. Hi, everybody. As Dean said, I'm Kathy Harstead. I really don't know who all is on the line. I'm assuming that this is a mixture of parents and maybe some educators as well. But tonight, let's visit about dispute resolution a little bit. And let's just go through the information. But it also is helpful if we can have this be a conversation. So if you have a question or an example that you'd like to talk about as we go through, please feel free to take your phone off mute and raise it, because if you have that question, probably other people do too. I don't know that there's anyone in the field of dispute resolution that feels like they know it all. I certainly don't, and I think that people who are formal mediators or advocates who engage in dispute resolution quite a bit will tell you that they learn something new from every situation. On our first slide, we see a group of four people, and this would be something that four people tugging on a rope, and a lot of times if we're having a dispute with another party, we can go at it and they can go at it, and we're kind of looking at whoever is strongest is going to win, which means that someone is going to lose. And in good dispute resolution, I think we want to move toward a win-win solution. So keeping that in mind, I'm just going to go ahead to the next slide. I want to talk a little bit about parents speaking up for their children. Now, we have both moms and dads that are involved in planning for children with learning difficulties, but the overwhelming majority of people that are going to IEP meetings and I-504 meetings are women. And in our society, we're not always encouraged to speak up. And it can be difficult for some of us. Some people are not shy. I'm not particularly shy. I'm pretty comfortable with public speaking and speaking up. But it's not true of all of us. He hasn't been true of me my whole life. And so some of us are, particularly for women, maybe a little nervous about speaking up for our child. So this second slide, this quote is for you. If not you, who? And if not about this issue, then what issue will be important enough for you to speak up? And if not now, then when? And so it's okay to speak up for your child. There's nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of pressures that sometimes send us messages that say it's not okay. And if we're not comfortable with it, or we don't practice, we might not do it as well as we would like. We may get very emotional, or we may be at a loss for words, or we may hold back, or we may come on like gangbusters, and all of those kinds of strategies can undermine what we're trying to do in dispute resolution. So I like the phrase speaking up for your child, because it's that's really something that any parent can do, and it's all good. Going on to the next slide, We have a definition of dispute resolution. With dispute resolution, there's a conflict, usually a different way of looking at the same issue. And we want to use either informal or formal communication techniques to work that out. We want to find a solution that's fair and that meets the needs of the student under the rules of law. And sometimes that can be a challenge to do. When we are involved with dispute resolution, the situation is not always going to feel comfortable. There may be some tension. So good dispute resolution doesn't mean there won't be tension or conflict, but we're going to use that tension to push ourselves as a team to arrive at a solution. Conflict or differing opinions is normal and natural. Whenever you have people get together, you're bound to have conflict. And sometimes it's ongoing depending on what the situation is. It's how we respond to that conflict that will create change and new possibilities. And there are some ways of responding to conflict that are counterproductive for us as parents, and there are some ways that really help us move forward as a team. And those are the dispute resolution strategies that we want to get in our toolbox as parents. I don't know how many of you have ever worked with someone who is just a great communicator. Somebody who comes to mind for me is Bob Rutten. He does the dispute resolution portfolio for the Department of Public Instruction, and he is a wonderful communicator. And if I could communicate like he could, or if everyone I ever worked with was as good a communicator as Bob is, you know, I'm sure the amount of conflict would be low and life would be easy. But I'm not always the best communicator, and neither are other people on the team. So I have to work hard at this. Look at the conflicts that come up as an opportunity to speak up for my child and work toward a good solution. People are going to see problems differently based on their perceptions. And we want to learn what other people are thinking and use that in thoughtful ways. When our emotions get involved, we have a tendency to label other people when they disagree with us. Oh, they're just being stubborn. Oh, they're being so obnoxious. I can't believe she said that. We start in, and we take what was already a conflict, and we add to it with our viewpoint. And that's easy to do when it's your kid on the line. We all have a tendency to go there. So what I'm saying, I guess, as we go to the next slide, is that dispute resolution is difficult. There's emotion. The parent has strong feelings about what is or what isn't happening. And if we want to resolve the dispute, we have to stick with our plan to stay calm. And often what catches parents in the IEP planning process is a surprise. Somebody will say something or do something that they didn't expect. We thought it was going to be a parent-teacher conference. All of a sudden, it was turning into an IEP meeting. Or we thought it would be an IEP meeting, but no, they said it was just going to be a parent-teacher conference this time. We thought we were going to talk about this, but somebody on the team decided to talk about that. Or there was a person there that we didn't expect. And they took a stance on an issue, and so we get taken by surprise. I'm hearing some beeps on the phone. Is everybody still there?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Still here?
Good. I just heard a beep like somebody was trying to come in, and so I thought, well, I hope I'm not blithering on. And we lost everybody. Thank you, Denise. one of the things I like to coach families to do is if you do get caught by a surprise, particularly if it's a surprise on an issue that you weren't expecting, and people say, well, we don't do this with ESY, or we, you know, you have to do it this way, or we can't do this because of that, whatever it is, take a moment to ask people, what is the basis for that decision, or what is the basis for that approach in IDEA? Help me understand how this comes as part of the law, because I'm not understanding this. My understanding is different. And if what is happening is somebody is just repeating a policy that they don't understand, they're going to have a hard time doing that, and that will help bring that out in the dispute resolution process. So you really want to be clear on what it is people are saying in the meeting and what the basis is for that in the law. And if you can bring information with you, if you know the issues going into a meeting that are likely to come up for you and the team, and you can bring some information about ESY with you, or bring some information about the IEP process with you, it's often very helpful to the team in resolving a dispute. We encourage people to take along our pocket guide because it has some of the real basic points involved with assessment and team planning that are an easy reference for the team. And a lot of times that can be helpful if a dispute comes up. Even though it's dispute resolution, I'm going on to the next slide now, even though dispute resolution is difficult, it is a skill I can learn. We have to, as parents, watch our self-talk in our heads about what we're telling ourselves. Oh, so-and-so over here can do this, but I can't do it. You may not do it like so-and-so over there does it, but we can all learn some basic dispute resolution strategies and have these tools in our toolbox when we go into a team meeting. And the first one I want to talk about is what we call team building. If the team is new, which it is almost every year, and a problem occurs or a crisis occurs, we want there to be trust available because we've done some team building. So one of the things that I have said that I think is helpful for team building is, especially if my child is in a new school or a new program, and I'm on the phone with that teacher or the special ed teacher at the beginning of the year, or it's the first time the team has met, you know, before we plunge into talking about the present level of performance and all of the things that we typically do in an IEP process, I want to have a conversation with the other team members and say things like, this is the plan that we developed for my child last spring, and I know it's new to most of you. You're just being handed this, and you really didn't have any input into what this plan looks like. I want this to be a great year for my kid, and I want you to be comfortable talking with me, and I want to be able to talk to you. If you have concerns or something in this plan doesn't make sense, let's trust each other enough to talk about it. It's hard to say no to that. Or if my child, which happens to be the truth, has a number of challenging behaviors, you know, I may say something like, Sarah is a great kid, and I think that y'all are really going to like her, but I know that some point this year she will have a difficult day. And when that happens, I want us to pull together as a team. I want you to feel comfortable picking up the phone and calling me and just telling me if it's a tough day or what you're thinking, so that we can go forward together when those things happen. I think we have a good plan in place. Hopefully we'll minimize the big problems, but let's work to, you know, I have those kinds of conversations with the team because that team building is forms a foundation that we can go back to when a problem comes up. For my communication style, you know, if I need to rant and kind of vent or fixate on my fears and concerns, I do that on a weekend before I go to the team meeting. But when I go into the meeting, I try to stay really calm, state clear goals. I want to show appreciation for what the other members of the team are going through and doing, and I hope they'll show the same appreciation to me. And then as I state the goal, I want to ask for the yes and show the team that I believe we can do this. So those are some early dispute resolution or pre-dispute kinds of strategies that we want to have in our toolbox. And the words I'm using, my style in doing this, is it may not be something that you can imitate exactly. Everybody has to find their own voice in this. So when you go into a meeting, don't try to talk like Kathy Harstad, because you're not, and I can't talk like you, but try to find your own voice in building the team or communicating, because it can help. Conflict will happen. It may not happen this year. It may not happen for 3 or 4 years, and then all of a sudden it happens. Or there may be a lot of conflict. It just depends on what's going on. But when it does, we really want to have that foundation as a team that we can go back to. And I find that sometimes I'll get a case manager or a teacher who's the case manager, and they'll do that team building. They know how to facilitate that. And when that happens, that is great. That is a really good thing. But some years the teacher's brand new. And I don't wait for anyone to tell me it's okay to do those kind of team building things. I'm wondering if anybody on the phone has done some team building in the IEP process or in meetings with teachers and administrators to kind of bring people together with the sense that we're all in this together and let's work together. Does anybody have any examples of things that you've done to try to start off the year with a positive note or really help the team feel that we can trust one another?
Anybody?
I heard some beeps in there, so now did anybody... Is that from muting, taking your buttons off of mute?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, Kathy, this is Vicki Peterson. I think over the years I've tried to do some team building within Aaron's IEP team. You know, just by making sure that before every IEP meeting that as a parent I've sent out you know, things that I want to talk about and talk about how I, you know, excited to hear what their views are and strategies are and, you know, how they see Aaron compared to how I see Aaron. I make sure that before I go to IEP meetings, I kind of look over my cheat sheets on how to be a really good listener. And I think that's helped my IEP team to build trust over the years. I've been fortunate to have some people on his IEP team since early intervention. So I always kind of look to them as well to help me with the new members of an IEP team so they can know where Aaron was in the past and where he is now compared to, you know, his development or his social skills at school or how far we've come, and to really, you know, even though there may be some negatives in the IEP meeting, just to make sure that we always start out on a positive note, and hopefully we'll be ending on a positive note.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Go ahead. Well, this is Jolene. I was just going to say one thing that I don't know if I've ever put it under the team building activity, but I think it might fit is, I have brought pictures of my son to an IEP meeting of, like, a birthday party or a vacation or something, and we pass them around before the meeting starts while everyone's kind of getting ready. And that's really worked well because they get to see his life at home and know him more as like a person than just a student. And then also I get to see their reactions to those pictures and how much they care about him. And it kind of just builds us up as a team, I think, with those pictures.
So we have lots of examples and lots of wisdom within this group of people who have tried to use some of these strategies. Teams don't become teams automatically. And if you've had negative experiences with a team in the past, it can be doubly important to take the time to do these kinds of activities with your team. I think for me and maybe for a lot of people, trust, I like to think of trust as like a coin with two sides. You can't really have the coin if both sides aren't there. So part of the one side is what we call accountability, which means doing what you say you'll do. And it's hard to trust a team if they're not doing what they say they'll do. So that's one part of trust. But on the other side of that coin is a capacity within ourselves to trust. And that's like a little plant. We have to nurture that for it to grow. And so team building can't really take place without trust, which means we're going to have to take some risks. And we're going to have to hold ourselves and the rest of the team accountable. The next slide shows the kind of primary conflicts that we see at Pathfinders across the state. Most of the time, teams aren't in conflict unless one of these five things starts to happen. There's an important service or a service that the parent's view is really important for this child, and it's not being provided. It may be in the plan, but it's not being provided. Or that important service is going to be discontinued. Someone on the team has said, I don't think we can provide speech therapy for this child anymore. We are at conflict right there. Or an important service may need to be modified or changed. Maybe something that was delivered in the regular classroom isn't going to be delivered there anymore. If we go the way one team member is suggesting, and that might be a concern, an important service may not be accepted by the parents. Sometimes the school wants to provide certain services, and the parent says, no, I don't want that for my kid. And suddenly there's a conflict. Or the parent just really feels that a fundamental primary need of that student is not being met. The team just hasn't gotten there. So these are the five main kinds of conflicts that we see going on with parents. And these are what I call primary conflict, because these are actually conflicts over services, which is what special education is. It's a service. So on slide 8, in addition to primary conflicts, we can also, because we're human and we're not perfect, we get into secondary conflicts as well. And here are some of the secondary conflicts that we see a lot of at the parent center when families call or email us. Sometimes a partner's role is being disputed, or people on the team are acting like a parent is out of line or a teacher is out of line with what they're saying. Or a partner's style is being resisted. The concerns they have for their child are always legitimate, but the way we're coming across is being resisted. And that can happen both ways. Sometimes a partner's information is just being discounted. If I had a nickel for every time somebody told me that the behavior my daughter engages in is what all kids do, I'd be a rich person. And you know, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes I'm trying to share a concern as a parent and somebody's trying to reassure me. So they'll discount what I have to say and try to reassure me that this isn't really an issue. And then I don't feel heard. Then all of a sudden we have a secondary conflict going on over communication. I may just be annoyed. I may just not show that conflict, but those kinds of things can build up in the team process. And when a primary conflict comes up, then it's much harder if these kinds of secondary conflicts are going on. Sometimes there's a systemic issue contributing to a conflict. Maybe this school has never served a child with autism before, and now they have to. And they have no idea how to proceed. Those kinds of, when you're having to build everything as a team because services aren't in place, they can really cause a lot of extra tension and frustration into the team process. And not all systemic issues are under our control as parents. We want to use good communication and go into a team meeting and say the right thing and do the right thing. But the fact is, sometimes, no matter what we say or how well we put it, we may not get what we want. And so often that's the case when there's a systemic issue that's going on in that particular district.
This is Sandy Cathy. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Can I ask a question? No, my name is Sandy, and I don't have any children in school, but I am still working with the community as a volunteer to bring other things to our community. And when you talk about these teams, so that I can understand, do all districts in North Dakota have this team set up with parents who have children who need that special, the special needs?
Right.
They all do.
Yes, the short answer to that is yes. Sometimes a parent will have a child with a disability and that child isn't found to be eligible for special education services, and so they may have a different kind of team. They may have a 504 planning team. But if their child's disability is recognized under IDEA, which is the special education law, and they're found eligible for special ed services, then a team of people will help that parent write an individual educational plan for that child, and that's the team that I'm talking about.
Okay, because ironically, I was at another meeting this evening, and I happened to have about 10 minutes with the parent who does have a child with some special needs. And I could see that there was some frustration there. You know, the word that I think I could use here is there was some segregation. The concern of the parent was that the child was being very segregated in that district. And, mm-hmm. I guess that would be something, that maybe that parent could bring to a team to say, I'm feeling that when I walk into that school, I see such a segregation.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, those are things that makes the child feel uncomfortable because they're probably being put into, where they're not integrating them with children who don't need those special needs.
So there are all kinds of secondary conflicts that come up. One of the things we see a lot is teams are trying to solve problems. Really, that's what a team is they're a planning group that tries to solve problems, and a lot of times the team doesn't really have enough information to come up with a good solution. So everybody is trying to solve the problem based on what they know. And if they don't have enough collective information within the group, we can't really arrive at a good solution, and the dispute will continue. So it's important for teams to take a step back now and then and say, I wonder if we don't need some more expertise on this, or we don't seem to be able to solve this on our own. Is there someone else in the district who could come and sit in with us and help us work through this? And we can have those conversations as parents as well as the educators in the room. We don't have to wait for someone else to suggest that. Sometimes teams start using counterproductive strategies. We get into a them and a us kind of a conflict, and that usually happens when trust and communication breaks down. Sometimes we do have a partner on the team who says things that are red flag words for us as parents, or vice versa, and so that can add to the conflict that we're experiencing. So these are some secondary conflicts to watch for in your team meetings. And try to identify what's happening. If you feel tension rising or you feel that you're getting pretty frustrated with this process, see if you can just kind of put a name to what's going on. Is this a primary conflict or are there some secondary things happening? And how do I want to address that as a parent? Some of the systemic issues on the next slide are if people on the team have limited training or information, limited time or energy. The parent is bringing up assistive technology for the child with an intellectual disability, and the district really hasn't developed any policies to address that issue. They haven't done assessments on assistive technology before. So everyone on the team is feeling their way because there's no policies that they can fall back on. Sometimes people have a limited awareness of parent rights. It might be the parent that has that limited awareness. It might be another team member who does. Sometimes teams feel pressure to resolve issues in a certain way, and we'll pick up on that as parents. If we think the teacher or the administrator is really being pressed to respond a certain way, instead of looking at the individualized needs of a child. And that can happen, you know, just to parents as well. So those are real systemic issues that sometimes the team has to stop and identify and work through before they can really get back to building that individual plan. And I guess what I'm saying with all this is that the IEP process can be terribly complex. And most of us aren't that complex. We're pretty basic people. We want to just come in and say what we say and get this plan put together and have it work. We want to be able to mention what we want, have that understood and picked up on, and just get her done. And all of a sudden, there's a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, we didn't volunteer for that as parents. It's like any relationship. We just want to be understood. And sometimes we need to take the leadership or the initiative to deal with some of those complexities. And if we don't feel like we have the skills to do that, then we may need to visit with someone who can help us with that. Dispute resolution options happen on a continuum. I've gone on to the next slide, as you can see. So we start with capacity building and prevention, early dispute assistance. Then there are more formal conflict resolution options for us. There are procedural safeguards and legal review. And so we kind of hope as parents we're not going to have to go down that legal review channel because it usually gets very adversarial by that point. But many of the rights and safeguards that are in place today are in place because teams couldn't agree and it did need to go through the courts to get things resolved. Dispute resolution takes a lot of energy. There's time, the difficulty level, our comfort level, our ability to take risk or the number of fears that we have, the number of children with special needs that we have, the formality of the situation at times, and confrontations that can occur. And because of that, it's really wise to do some thinking about whether this is something your child needs or something that you want, if there is a conflict. And how much energy do you have to put into a dispute resolution process? There are things that we wanted for our daughter that we weren't getting. And some of them were important. And so we took the time to say, hey, I want to do this differently. We're having a dispute here, and here's you know, here's what we could do as a team. And we really put the time in on those things. There were other things that we decided that it wasn't worth the energy. Or we didn't have enough time. You know, I could have given up my job, for example, and been a full-time advocate for my daughter, but I didn't want to do that. I chose not to do that. Another parent may choose to do that. Everybody has to weigh that for themselves, and it's okay whichever way you go, as long as you are aware of the impact on yourself and your family and your child. Sometimes we do get calls from parents who are engaged in long-term disputes with the school. They are spending enormous amounts of energy on that. The dispute is not being resolved very effectively. The stress level that that parent is experiencing is enormous, and they begin to do a number of mildly desperate things, some of which may be counterproductive. And so if you're finding yourself in that kind of a situation in dispute resolution, it's really wise to take a step back. We don't have to be the perfect parent. We don't have to have the perfect IEP. We get a window of time with our child when they're young. We want to take the best advantage of that we can. And we want a team of people to come together with us to help our child succeed in school and learn some great skills that they're going to need throughout their life. And so balance is just something that goes along with dispute resolution that we have to work at. Having a child with special needs can keep your life out of balance as it is. And so we really have to think about that. Some other ways of building capacity or prevention have to do with parent engagement. You know, maybe you are forming a study group on autism in your region, or maybe you're part of a FEET community in your region, or maybe you're going to conferences or getting training. Anything you can do as a parent to build your capacity and build the team capacity and prevent conflicts, you know, is a good thing. Sometimes states even have collaborative rulemaking. For example, in North Dakota, the autism guidelines right now are really in need of renovation. You know, I can't say that word. You have to be updated. Thank you, Kathy. And so you might decide as a parent that that would be really a good way to have some input into the system so that systemic things that make your job harder get addressed. So there are lots of different ways that we can get involved as parents. And again, you have to weigh that as well. Not every parent needs to be part of a work group or do those kinds of leadership things in that way. For some of us, just getting through the day and speaking up for a child is all we have energy for. And there's nothing wrong with that either. But it's another part of the early dispute resolution process, is just to engage in those kinds of activities. And if you're not going to be doing that, maybe stay in touch with the people who are and just kind of keep in touch with what's happening. Prevention in dispute resolution can involve these kinds of communication behaviors. Mentioning, I put that at the top because mentioning prevents very little. We all want to just stop there. We talked about it as the IEP. Well, we said it. Well, I wrote it into the goal. Well, we mentioned something. And when things don't happen as a result of mentioning, we get pretty frustrated. So I put that in there, but it's really kind of the lowest level of communication. Clarifying, requesting, determining, I like that word because that is really a team action. Bringing resources to the meeting, working to build ownership for an idea, brainstorming, troubleshooting, confronting not people but confronting the real issue, reframing, which means maybe kind of overlooking the negative way that somebody put something in, maybe restating it in more positive terms, that you can buy into. And one of the best things that we can do as parents is really begin to look for examples in communication where people use these kinds of strategies. And when you hear somebody do it, you go, oh, I wish I'd have done that. That was a good way to put that. Or that really got the team turned around. And this is where videos and other kinds of training can really help us as parents learn how to use these kinds of strategies to kind of prevent conflicts from happening or to really get at the underlying problem that the team has to address instead of kind of going at each other or just being frustrated with each other's personalities. I would like our center to do more in this area. I wish we had more video on our website that showed examples of how to do this. I think it would be really helpful to families. And one of my goals is to try to strengthen our work in this area over the next couple of years. One of the really good websites, if you want to see some people using these strategies, would be the CADRE website, which has been completely renovated, and I have a link to that at the end of the PowerPoint. So if you haven't gone on there recently and looked, I would encourage you to do that. They have a lot of resources on that webpage that give you ideas about how to do some of these strategies in the team meeting process. Early dispute assistance is the next level of dispute resolution. And so this is where we're preparing for the IEP meetings with support. So lots of people, for example, will call us or they may call Family Voices and kind of just ask someone to help them plan out an agenda of how to handle things at that meeting. Or maybe they'll ask us to come into their region in the state and do an IEP clinic where we actually look at IEPs and issues that teams are facing and do some brainstorming together on how teams can address those. A lot of times practicing what to say with a partner. If you're having a conflict and you and the case manager, you and the principal aren't able to resolve it, maybe asking for a meeting with someone else from the district to try to put your heads together and see if we can come to a resolution. A lot of parents call us just to find out if what they're thinking about their rights is true. They want to make sure going into that meeting that they know those rights, and they really want to have a chance to ask questions from a lot of different perspectives. Gives them confidence when they try to resolve disputes. And so that's another service that we offer. I do encourage families to find the ally within the system. If you're having a conflict with person A over an issue, that person still may be your ally. If you can think of some common ground where the two of you agree, start there and then come back to the issue. When the issue is resolved, it's the person that will be spending the most time with your child, or that's the person that you'll really be able to rely on long term. So we want to separate that idea that, I'm kind of frustrated with this person right now. I'm really having a conflict with her. But I know behind that she or he is my ally. And if we can just get over this hump, we can go back together to being a good team for my child. The ally within the system may be someone you haven't met yet. So, it's really important to get to know those players in your unit, special ed unit, or within the system to see who you can ally with. And sometimes maybe that person will be the one to speak up for your child, depending on what the issue is. You can bring support to the meeting, and we will talk about that a little more in just a minute. I want to come back to that one if it would be all right. So these are some early things that you can do beyond team building to to help yourself with dispute resolution. If, for whatever reason, those steps are not successful, and sometimes they're not, then we get into our more formal conflict resolution options. So we have what we call the facilitated IEP. And I want to take a little time with this one because it's an underused service in our state, and it's a really important service. A facilitated IEP, the state employs neutral facilitators who are trained to run the meeting. Basically, they're trained to facilitate the IEP process so that that meeting and that planning takes place as it should for the child. It kind of takes the pressure off the school. It takes the pressure off the parent because you have that trained facilitator who really knows how IEPs are supposed to work and works hard to bring that team together. It's a system or it's a process that works best if it's used early on, and it does require both parties to agree that they want to use facilitated IEP. So the superintendent of a district actually has to agree that they will do this before the state will provide the service. But it, most parents don't want to go down the road of very more formal kinds of conflict resolution. It takes a lot of time and energy, and it can be a tension-filled process. And so if we can use something like a facilitated IEP, it really helps. Sometimes the way to resolve the conflict, particularly if it's a real systemic problem, is a written complaint to the Department of Public Instruction. There are some time limits. You can't complain about something that happened 6 years ago. You know, they're not going to do that. It's got to be a complaint about something that's fairly current. And doesn't have to be formally, you know, you don't have to have a lawyer draw it up. But it does have to be a complaint about implementation of special education services under IDEA. So, you know, you're not, a complaint isn't going to be heard if you're complaining that you didn't get to choose your child's teacher, because IDEA doesn't give you that right as a parent. But if you're saying that the IEP simply isn't being implemented and you've attempted to resolve this at the local level and the bottom line is the services aren't being carried out and you can't get it resolved and you're complaining, they have 60 days to respond to that complaint. They investigate it. And there are times when it's appropriate to move right to a written complaint, depending on the circumstances. Mediation is a third type of conflict resolution option. In mediation, there's an ombudsman, I can't never say that word, or a third-party consultation person who comes in to mediate the disagreement. And that is really effective when both parties are communicating calmly and clearly. They understand each other's position, but they just disagree. And they really need help to get the conflict resolved. They need a formal, skilled mediator to bring the two parties together and negotiate a solution. And it's a very effective service. All of these services are offered through the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction. Bob Rutten is the contact person for them. And he can help you as a team figure out which one of these might be in your best interest and guide you through the application process. And we can, too. Parents do call us and ask about this. And we get a hold of the forms for them and show them how the process works. That's part of our role as a Parent Training and Information Center. The resolution meeting is a meeting that now by law must take place before there can be a due process hearing, before you can have a formal court hearing where you actually require the school to appear before a hearing officer and the hearing officer decides the outcome, reviews the concerns against the law, and makes a formal legal decision that all the parties have to live with. There must be a resolution meeting to try to resolve things before the final court process. And that resolution meeting is facilitated again by the Department of Public Instruction. So these are the more formal conflict resolution options. And I wondered if anybody on the call has any questions that you'd like to ask about this.
Kathy, this is Vicki.
Yeah.
When you talk about these three processes, you know, just reading some of the state performance plans, there's like very little, of course, for due process, there's barely any, and very little for mediation. Do you think that there are more IEP facilitations than with such little in the other areas?
Unfortunately, I don't. There are, of course, facilitated IEP meetings that occur every year, and sometimes the facilitators, when I talk to the facilitators, they'll tell me that they could have done more, but they were brought in too late. Many parents are intimidated by the facilitated IEP process because they have to get that superintendent to sign off on it, and they don't want to ask them, or they're just intimidated. There's clearly good reasons why that is. You know, you can't go into a meeting and agree to have this. Normally, it's the case manager who's facilitating a meeting. And the school gives up that role for a facilitated IEP process, and they have to agree. So my wish would be that we would continue to work on that one and try to find a way to make it less intimidating for parents, because it's a really good service, and I wish that more parents and schools would request it.
I was just curious because the numbers are so low, you know, even though these are written in, you know, when your child enters special education, these are written into your parental rights, you know, but thinking that they're rarely discussed. And, I mean, I can understand part of that because you want to go into this thinking you'll never have to use those.
Right.
But, you know, it just seems like we have, if, you know, I wonder if anybody does surveys considering how many parents actually know about that process, or are they entering those IEP meetings very defensive and not realizing that they could request other things? Because you say that it takes, you know, usually facilitations are entered in too late.
Right. We have not done a survey of parents to see if they have used these processes or been told about these processes. That's a thought, but we haven't done that at this point in time. Maybe that's something we should visit about.
Yeah, I just think of some of the parents that, you know, said, well, you know, we were going to do facilitated, but it didn't really work. And they say, well, you know, I wish the IEP team would have, like, my team would have helped me understand what that was. Instead of finding out on their own, like going back through parental rights, or, you know, by the time they've called Pathfinder or DPI, so much has already been implemented or, you know, what may be happening. I'm just kind of curious on how many parents actually know.
One of the things, too, that I've discovered recently that happens with facilitated IEPs is that, let's say a parent in a school are having a conflict, so the parent will consult with Protection and Advocacy. And Protection and Advocacy will assign an advocate, which doesn't always happen, but let's say they have assigned an advocate to go to the meeting with the parent. And that advocate, you know, is a very effective advocate, but they are not an IEP facilitator. So a lot of times the parent will think, well, I've already got an advocate here, so why do I have to bring in another facilitator? But there's a difference between bringing an advocate to the meeting and having a facilitated IEP. when you bring an advocate to the meeting, they're basically role modeling for the team and the parent how to advocate for that child, and they're speaking up for the child as an advocate, but they're not running the meeting. An IEP facilitator is running the meeting and really has a lot of control over how the team is brought to handle the problem-solving process. So it's just really, most of the time when facilitated IEP works well, both the school and the parents end up feeling like they have learned a ton, and they leave that process feeling really good about it, especially if you can bring it in.
Do the state performance plans go into detail of how those meetings, what the outcomes are, or do they just give the data of how many there were?
The state performance plans, I don't think, go into that much detail, Vicki. But every year, the state, the Department of Public Instruction, meets with all of the directors of special ed at the beginning of the year, and they usually bring in their lawyer and go through what they learned from the dispute resolution process in the last year. They give the number of mediations, facilitated IEPs, and so forth. They have, in this case now, it would be Bob Rutten. It used to be Teresa Monikin, would talk about lessons learned from the facilitated IEP process. And I've only recently been able to sit in on those meetings, and they're really a learning opportunity. Last year we had a lawyer from DPI do a presentation on some of the formal dispute resolution options at the conference, and I thought that was very interesting, and I think that what we might want to do is have that conversation with Bob Rutten and see if he'll come and do a session for us at some point on these kinds of issues that you and I are talking about. Anybody can pick up the phone in our state and call DPI and give them feedback on their experiences with dispute resolution. And in addition to these, they will also just work with you as a parent to try to get some things resolved. If you don't want to go through these formal steps, they will offer suggestions or offer to even call the school and talk with them. They do maintain a neutral position, which is not a bad thing. It's a good thing, because how can we trust somebody as a parent if they're going to take sides? You don't want that. You want that neutrality. Vicki, I don't know if I answered your question. I think what you're trying to ask me is, shouldn't our state performance plan really get at some of these issues?
Yeah, I think that was my question. I mean, we think about the parents, and, you said it yourself. A lot of times they don't want to go through this formal thing, and then sometimes these disputes just go from one year to the next. But even though it's briefly described in your parents' rights, I just wonder if parents go, what's going to happen, in those? If we still don't come to an agreement, did I waste my time, So I would think that it would be helpful if, parents had something to go by to say, this is what possibly can happen. I think that parents that I talk to don't understand the difference between facilitated IEP and a mediation. They sound the same to me. What's the difference? Which one do I go for?
Right.
I think that I'm with you. They could call Pathfinder. They could call DPI. I'm just wondering if they do, because we have to, from the numbers I've seen and the data I've seen, we have very few.
Right.
But, on the other hand, I think, I talk to a lot of parents that are unhappy about their IEP situation.
Yeah, I don't know if I have anything I can add to that. We do have an opportunity, I guess, as parents on an annual basis to respond to the survey that DPI does. And the response rate among parents to that survey is very, very low.
Yeah.
And I'm sad about that because I think that's another opportunity that people have to really talk about whether their involvement in their child's education is being facilitated at the local level.
So is that survey, is that an annual survey then for the parents?
It is, and it's open currently, and it will be open until June 30th. And there's a link, an online link. And I'm sorry to say I don't have it right in front of me, but I can send it out to Denise if she wants to pass it on to the people on the call. If you have a child between the ages of 3 to 21, that's an important opportunity for us as parents. And the state is welcoming those comments and wanting to hear from us, so they have an opportunity to do that. And our response rate is just, you know, it's under 20%.
Is that also confidential then, those surveys?
They are, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like they wouldn't share the results. They share the results, but not in any way that is that can be tied back to somebody.
To a student or parent or
right.
school, which
yeah.
is good. Which is, again, then doesn't really reflect why you'd only have a 20% rate. You know, you would think that more would want to respond to use that to try to build off of
well,
you know, some of those
concerns. They get a lot of surveys, and for whatever reason, we just haven't responded to those much as parents across the state. I don't know. People get home at night and they're tired and they don't want to do one more survey. But this is one worth doing.
And that's, I think, where I'm going to ask, you know, Denise, if you can, I wouldn't mind passing that survey on to some, you know, granted I don't have any children that have had special needs challenges, but, you know, I think it is important even if, you know, if I've got somebody out there that I, like I said, I had an ear today that I was kind of bent with what I think are some, you know, some things that could probably be talked about, at, you know, early on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some school districts, when you're having your parent-teacher conference, that's when they discuss that survey.
Mm-hmm.
So here we've, you know, and then they've had laptops up online or whatever, you know, if you want to do it right there and then to do the survey. I don't know if they do that statewide, but I know they do that, you know, in different districts.
Mm-hmm. Right. It really varies from district to district. Last year, our response rate was a little better because DPI actually sent letters out to every family, but the OSEP, the Office of Special Education Programs, has indicated they want them to go back to an online process now, so they couldn't do that this year. With some exception, I mean, I'm sure that if a parent just didn't have access to something online, they would figure out something. Then at the legal review level, I'm going on just so we can finish the material. We have the dispute resolution hearing, and there is also, in some cases, there is other kinds of formal litigation that parents have where they've actually sued schools. Finally, sometimes there is legislation that a parent has been successful in getting passed in their state to deal with a systemic issue. I tried to put a little humor in this one. You can see the little character on the right. Instead of saying he's an alligator, he says, actually, I'm a litigator. I have to say that this is another way of resolving disputes. It's very formal, and by the time you get to this level, it's highly controversial. There's a lot of tension around this kind of solution. It costs a lot of money. There's a lot of risk for parents in being able to do this. We have very few. Other states aren't quite the same way. For some reason, North Dakota, just culturally, people try to avoid this one. I wanted to review the chain of communication. Your first line of communication is with your child's teacher, then your special education or related services personnel. And not every special ed teacher is a case manager. Sometimes the special ed teacher will be what they call the case manager. Sometimes there's a coordinator that will do that. Depends on the district and how they're organized. You just need to ask your child's teacher, if we can't resolve this, who else in the district can I visit with to try to see what we can work out? There's a principal, there's an assistant superintendent, a superintendent, the all the way up to the hearing officer. So just be aware of who the chain of communication is. And generally speaking, if you skip somebody in the line, somebody may want you to go back and visit with someone else in that chain of communication. If you get into a little more formal kinds of dispute resolution, or if you're working on that team building and you're trying to avoid conflicts by, you know, preventing them, these are the kind of approaches that people who engage in formal mediation and formal dispute resolution activities say are most likely to work in favor of parents and students. So a readiness to be helpful, a real openness in our communication, a trusting and friendly attitude, being real sensitive to common interests, and focusing on that common ground, de-emphasizing. You know, it's in the interest of both the school and the parent to teach children to read. It's in the interest of both school and the parents to help children learn mathematics. So those are our common ground. And in working to resolve disputes, we want to come back there, which means we're going to have to ignore or overlook some things in order to get there, and take a we can do this rather than you have to do this. A lot of people call us and ask, can they do that? Well, the short answer is yeah, people can do anything. But the real question is, what do we want as a team? Where are we going with this? And how are we going to get there? So just some strategies for our toolboxes. We want to work to a win-win solution. So you're going to have a positive relationship if achieving your goal as a parent is more likely to happen if the whole team is achieving their goals. I don't want to achieve my daughter's goal at the expense of everyone else on the team. So if the teacher is saying that they can't do that in their classroom, I want to really listen to that and see if we can work towards something that they can do. If my goal is to build my child's memory, reciting a nursery rhyme is only one way of getting there. And if that's not working for the teachers, then maybe there are other ways we can build my child's memory. Negative relationships occur when you believe that your success relies on other people not attaining their goals. So you get into kind of a win-lose dynamic. It is likely, if the dispute is really serious, that you may feel angry. And you may see other people who get angry. Anger is not a crime. How we express it and what we do with it, of course, matters very much. And we often feel it before we really understand why we're feeling angry. And so when you see someone else become angry or you feel that anger start to rise in you, try to figure out what is the cause. What is it that you need? What is that anger telling you? And I've listed some common reasons that people get angry in the dispute resolution process. When you're working through that emotion and trying to get to the win-win solution, you want to be able to listen really carefully for the difference between positions and interests. Positions are what people want or say they want. They take a position on this. We're not providing ESY services, or we are not going to provide transportation on the regular bus for your child because they need one-on-one support and we're not doing it. That's the position. The interests are the needs or the concerns or the desires of that person that motivated them to take that position. So the reason that they're not providing that transportation on the regular bus is because they're not sure that they can cover the supervision required, or they're not sure that they're sure that their insurance will cover it on the special bus but not on the regular bus. Whatever it is, there's a concern about meeting those kinds of issues that the person may not be saying. They must just say, we won't do it. So if you can get at the underlying interest that they have, you can move the communication and the dispute resolution to a different level. And frankly, these are very complex strategies, and not every parent is going to feel comfortable doing this. Some of us, we have our limitations, and so we need professional help when it comes to communication at this kind of level. But for other people on the call, they might say, yeah, I kind of get that. I think I can do that. Or I've been in meetings where we've had to get below the surface stuff to what the real issues are. So I think I can be looking for this and use this as an opportunity to, next time I'm finding myself in conflict with someone, I'm going to try to get behind what they're saying to see what their interests are, and then see if we can't find some common ground. I wanted to take a minute, in light of we've been talking about dispute resolution, and talk about some common things that kind of come up in IEP meetings that can help us during the communication process or not, and see what the group thinks. So this is one that we hear a lot. Always bring another person with you to the IEP. Is that the truth? Should you always do that, or is that a myth? What does a group think?
Well, I always say it's a good rule of thumb. Just because the other person might hear something that I didn't.
So Janine thinks it's a really good rule of thumb. Anybody else? Nope, Denise said it was a good rule of thumb. Nobody else is saying anything.
Well, I can't say anything. This is Sandy again. I have never had an IEP meeting. So, you know, I'm really out there. I mean, this is educational at the point of which, you know, I think that's great that they're doing this for these.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'll give you my take on it. I would say, you know, maybe. It depends on who that person is and what their role is going to be. and how they'll be perceived by the team. Whenever you bring another person to the IEP meeting, it changes the dynamics, and we just have to acknowledge that as parents. You know, if that other person comes to the meeting and sits back with their arms crossed and glares at everyone, it's less than helpful. If the person comes to the meeting and you explain to the team that it's just really hard for you to participate and keep good records, and your friend Mary or Bruce or whoever, you know, has offered to come with you and take some notes for you, that kind of diffuses the tension of who is this person? Are they a member of the team or are they just here? And why are they here? You don't have to justify bringing someone else, but it does affect the dynamic. So it's important to think through, if you're asking someone to come, who is coming and what is their role going to be and how will I explain that to the team? Because sometimes, especially if parents are getting tense about something, they bring another person to the meeting and they often will tell me, well, I'm doing this because I feel so, it's so out of balance because there's all these professionals and it's just me. But then they're bringing that person to kind of support their side, which means there's a side, and then all of a sudden we're into conflict in a little bit different way. So I encourage parents to bring another person if you feel a need to have that person there, and to think about what it is you want from them and how you're going to introduce them to the team. Another statement we have on here is that Pathfinders will advocate for you. Is that truth or myth?
It's myth. You'll advocate with them.
Yeah, it is myth. It is myth. We do not go to meetings as formal advocates for parents. Our role is information and training. We are starting to go to IEP meetings, and I find that most of the time parents really want us there as their personal advocate, and we can't fill that role. But we can go and be an observer, and we can use what we learn in the information and training process. And maybe that's just a fine line that really means advocacy. I'm not really sure, but that's kind of our role at this point. We're not an organization that is there to beat up on the school for anybody. Can you?
But one thing that you can do, Kathy, is help the family prepare.
Yes, absolutely. Can do that. Can you record the IEP meeting? Or the statement says you can record the IEP meeting. Is that true? Can you bring a recorder in and record that meeting? Is that legal?
It's true.
It is true. You can record the meeting. We're a team, so we're not playing gotcha here. We're not springing this on people. We're communicating in advance. We're not asking for permission, but we're letting people know. Truth or myth, you can visit your child's classroom. Do you have a right to do that?
Truth.
I had to actually investigate this one this year, because, and I found that I didn't know the answer, so I had to do some checking. And the truth is, there's nothing in the law that gives you a right to visit your child's classroom. There's nothing in North Dakota law. There's nothing in IDEA that gives you that right as a parent. There's also nothing in the law to prevent it. There's nothing in the law that says you can't. But there's also nothing in the law that says that you can. Most of us think of it as a right. We have a right to visit our child's classroom.
So then it would fall back on school policy.
Yeah, it falls back on school policy. And the fact is, most of us can't go into the classroom to observe our child and not have it change the dynamics. And sometimes that's a very good thing. Many, many principals and teachers encourage parents to visit the classroom, and we'll continue to do that. Occasionally, someone is uncomfortable with it. And if we're going to negotiate that, we can negotiate it, but we can't do it on the stand that we have an absolute right under the law to do it, because it's, I'm afraid it's not there. So that's a hard one. You can ask for a break during the meeting. Can you stop the meeting and take a break in the IEP process?
True.
Absolutely. And sometimes it's a really good thing. Truth or myth, you can learn to think on your feet. You can. People who are good at it weren't always. They weren't born. You know, at 18 months, they couldn't think on their feet. At 5 years old, they couldn't think on their feet. People who think on their feet do a lot of observing other people, and they learn from each other. If you don't feel comfortable thinking on your feet, you can get better at it. You have to have a little faith in yourself. What you are feeling will be hidden from other people. What do you think? Is that truth or myth? I don't know. Deneen, do you have a poker face?
No.
I don't either. Everything I'm feeling is written all over my face. So I have to know that about myself. There may be some parents who are good at hiding what they're feeling. I'm not one of them. If I do become very emotional and feel myself start to break down in a meeting, that doesn't happen very often, but it has happened, I try to let the team know right away that why they're seeing that rush of emotion. And I ask for a little time. Here are some resources on dispute resolution that I would encourage all parents to become familiar with. We have CADRE, the National Center on Dispute Resolution in Education, wonderful resource. This is a resource that OSAP has put together on dispute resolution that's very good. If you want to get a real basis or background on how special ed is looking at dispute resolution, that's a good site to go to. And then, if you want to see what's happening in North Dakota, what the different processes are and how to apply and so forth, there's the Department of Public Instruction website on dispute resolution. So that's, Deneen, I don't know if we got everything that you wanted to cover in this.
You did. Training,
but
does anybody have any questions for Kathy at all?
And we can talk about real conflicts if you're comfortable doing that. Or otherwise you can have a friend of a friend of a friend and hypotheticals too.
If we do that, Kathy, I might stop the recording.
That might be a good idea, Deneen.
Right.
And you don't have to give an example of something you'd like to solve. I mean, you can, something that you're thinking about going into an upcoming meeting. But you can also just talk about something that you encountered and how you...